All right, Dr. Julie Randolph Haybecker. You were just on the podcast, the 55th episode, Women in Medicine, where I had you and two other professors. And then afterwards, you sent me this email like, hey, I would like to come on by myself. So thanks again for asking to come on.
Sure, absolutely.
So today we're going to talk about kind of your personal experiences with mental health. We were saying kind of before the recording, I think it's so awesome that a faculty member wants to speak out about their mental health, because I think we're progressive on campus. We have really good support staff, but yeah, not that many professors are super open about their experiences. So I think this is tremendous.
Sure. As I was saying, part of my journey is thinking about how can I help destigmatize mental illness and promote good mental health. How can I show my students that, you know, it's okay to come into medical school or into a work environment and know that you're dealing with a health issue that just happens to be a mental health issue? Mm-hmm. So that's what I was thinking, well, if I share a little bit about myself and what my journey has been, maybe that'll help people feel more comfortable with their journey.
I think it will. I know it will. Yeah. So you experienced some depression. Now, was this depression when you were kind of in grad school through the grind of all that, or have you, you know, even as an adolescent or so, were you dealing with some depression?
Yeah, so I thought about this a lot. So, I've dealt with low level to major depression throughout my life. And now that I think about it, you know, I think a lot of the symptoms I had maybe as an adolescent so I grew up with a parent who was an alcoholic.
Okay.
So, well, you're just dealing with that. Dealing with that's very stressful. In undergrad, well, you're not really depressed. You're just dealing with the stresses of school. And, you know, all throughout, I think I've tried to convince myself and even with my family, it was more acceptable to say, well, you're just stressed out. You're not depressed. You're not clinically depressed.
Yeah, you're not the D word. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, my father who was an alcoholic struggled a great deal with that diagnosis of depression because he was a physician.
Oh.
And so that was very stigmatizing at that point in his career in the small town that we grew up in. And so, you know, and I also think, you know, viewpoints on mental health were different then, right? So alcoholism is a weakness.
Yeah.
Depression is
it's a moral injury. Yeah.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And while that was really great, I mean, my parents were very much like, well, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I mean, that was good to help me, you know, get things done at the end of the day. But I think they didn't often feel really comfortable talking about.
So they weren't like, go to your doctor, go to a therapist. They're just like,
no. And we did, you know, around my dad's alcoholism, we did do family therapy and those things, but it was mainly centered around his drinking.
Yeah.
Not really the root. And so, you know, years later, you know, talking to my dad, realized that, you know, he was really self-medicating his depression. So, yeah, just it's always been kind of a struggle to, you know, even now my mom's like, "Well, you're okay now, right?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's as if I have diabetes, Mom. This is a thing that I have to stay up on. It's a chronic illness that I have to think about the management and how the management changes as I'm getting older." So yeah, that's, you know, we didn't really do a lot of, hey everyone, how's your mental health today?
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, there weren't really counseling services in high schools. And
so what did your depression look like? Meaning, you know, when I go into depression, I eat like a fiend. I isolate, I have no energy, you know, chores are everything. So I guess, yeah, is it similar for you or?
Yeah, so same thing. The first thing I notice is I start to isolate. And so I'll get comments from friends. Hey, where have you been? You know, hey, you haven't texted me back. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Eating, yeah, same thing. I self-soothe.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't help that you own a restaurant.
It doesn't help. It does not help. And my husband is a really good cook, so that doesn't help.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have disturbances in my sleep patterns, which I know are, one of the keys for me is to make sure that I have good sleep hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed in the past when I've not done kind of paid attention to sleep, paid attention to stress relief, that's when I really start to go down that hole. So for most of my life, it's just been that low level kind of constant depression. And then probably, I was thinking about it the other day, probably around 2011 is when I started to head into a major depression.
Okay.
So, again, really isolated. I didn't have really a lot of relationships with my friends at that point. My husband was like, wow, where are you?
And where were you at your career at that point?
So I was at the Hutch.
Okay.
I was a director of a laboratory.
Oh, okay. So you were very successful at that point of your
life.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was, pretty far along.
Mm-hmm.
The atmosphere was really strange because that was just coming out of the recession, if you remember.
Okay. Yeah.
The Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
And which was depressing enough.
Yeah.
And I realized there were, I was starting to use alcohol,
mm-hmm.
Which I was like, wait a minute, I know where this is headed.
Yeah.
I know exactly
where this is. I grew up with this, yeah.
Yeah, I know exactly where this is headed. And so I thought, wow, you know what, I need some help with this. And so I reached out to a couple therapists in Seattle, which the funny thing was, three of them never called me back.
Hmm.
Thank you, therapists.
Yeah.
And then I ended up connecting with a therapist who was great. He dealt a lot with people in that were physicians, scientists. So, he kind of got the pressures of that. And so we connected and we started talk therapy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So would you describe that as kind of your quote-unquote burnout, for lack of a better term? Or was that depression related to something else?
Yeah. So in talking to him and just having, it took a while to tease things out because there's childhood, I've scored a 4 on the ACE.
Mm. Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
not an achievement that you want. But, and then determining that I was really burned out. I was really burned out in my job. Talking about that and what that looked like. And then sharing with him my history, this is probably 6 months into our sessions together. And he goes, so, this trauma that you described to me, back in 1989, he goes, were you treated for PTSD? And I said, what?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, the anxiety that you have, the sleep issues, and so that had been ramping up. And he was like, yeah, this is classic PTSD. He goes, you've never been diagnosed mm-hmm. with PTSD? And I said, well, no.
And had you told physicians about that traumatic event, or had you just been kind of ignoring it?
So the traumatic event was a sexual assault in undergraduate. So that occurred at a time, again, my school had no training around sexual assault. It was a time when I would have been asked what I was wearing, what I had done that day.
Yeah.
There was not a climate to really report, and it was somebody I knew, so it didn't fit the, which is the pattern, right? Which is what we know now, the pattern. But back then it was, oh no, rapists are dressed in black and skulking in an alleyway, not friends that you know, you just misunderstood his intentions, you know? Mm. So I didn't, you know, so I reported the incident to my physician and we took care of the medical part of that. But there was no, and then I met with a rape counselor maybe twice. And, you know, it was more around, the lack of why I wouldn't be able to report. So it wasn't really around, okay, let's deal with this trauma, this traumatic event that happened to you by someone that, you know, you knew and you thought cared for you, you know. It was more, I don't think you have a good case. So, you know, just, you know, follow up.
Deal with it, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, and I realized, so this is 2011, at this 12 at this point, I've been carrying that for 20 years, you know. So that was a really painful process to kind of, you know, go through and then, you know, how do you go through this process where you take apart this trauma that you had 20 years ago and that you've spent 20 years walling off as much as you can, right? So that was a really painful process. So, you know, basically, I can't remember the name of the therapy, but you kind of talk through the event.
Okay.
Over and over and over and over again. And it's to make it part of your story. Mm-hmm. And so I equate it to taking, you know, a piece of radioactive material and unwrapping it and holding it as long as you can.
Okay, yeah.
And then wrapping it back up.
Yeah, so almost like an exposure therapy, sounds like.
But. And then the next time you unwrap it for a little bit longer. Mm. And so that probably took, you know, probably over a span of 2 years.
Wow.
To you know, get to a place where I can say that I was raped.
Yeah.
Right? Because I couldn't even say that. I couldn't say those words. You know, I couldn't say I was sexually assaulted. None of that. I couldn't say any of that. Mm-hmm. So, and that would cause a lot of anxiety for me. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I found, and I'm not trying to equate my experiences with, you know, a sexual assault because they were very different, but a traumatic experience nonetheless. Yeah. I remember when I first tried speaking out about committing to a psych ward, I would always get choked up about it and I couldn't do it. But the more that I continued to talk about it and share my story, I was able to, sounds strange, but almost wear it as like a badge of pride in a sense, or it doing all of this advocacy work and talking about it more has allowed me to deal with those feelings. And I'm not saying, of course, they're the same. I know it's very, very different. But
I don't think they... I mean, I'm never going to be that person that's like, well, my trauma was way worse than your trauma. Trauma is trauma, right? I think that's another piece that we need to let go is, you know, what you find traumatizing to you is what you find traumatizing. Mm. What I find traumatizing to me is what I find traumatizing. There's no scale, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you scored number 2 on the trauma scale, so you don't get to be upset about it, you know. And you should wear that as a badge of honor. The work, I now really appreciate the work. And at first, you know, I thought, well, I'm just going to go and talk about this stuff and feel better about it. I didn't realize the physical and emotional work it was going to take to unwrap that.
Yeah.
And then hold it. And then know that I was going to have to go back and talk about it again and again, and over a period of time. And there were times that I called, you know, my therapist and said, yeah, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. And he's like, okay. And I would go back because I could see incrementally that, yeah, it's like debriding a wound.
Yeah.
Right? So
I had, slow healing wound. Yeah.
You know, you got to scrape all that stuff out and then, you know, heal as much as you can. Right. So I was going through that process while I was in this just really, the work environment at the Hutch was just really odd at that period of time. So when I first went to the Hutch, I was a postdoc, and there's a lot of money in research.
Yeah.
And I was training with a woman who was great, Bev Torkstorb, really, really productive. And then I moved up and I was promoted and I had this lab. And then the culture started to shift a lot at the Hutch. And so where I felt like I really had a voice and a place at the table, even as a postdoc, I felt like that was diminishing. Plus I was, so just physically what they did during the recession, they came to me and they said, you have to lay off 3 people. So a full-time person, a half-time person, and my work study student. Keep in mind, at the time, the work study student, I paid them $3 an hour.
Oh, wow.
And the state paid them $9.
Okay.
To do things like clean the floor, take out the garbage, you know, do the stuff, the cleaning stuff. And so I said, so you know then that I'm going to have to pay someone $45 an hour, one of my technicians, to do this stuff. And they're like, it doesn't matter. You have to get rid of the work study student.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so they were making a lot of weird decisions. So I had to lay these people off because they thought we were going to lose revenue, but then the stimulus package came in. So if you remember, maybe you don't, but the stimulus package was initiative by the Obama administration to get the economy rolling. And part of it was putting a ton of money into biomedical research. So I reduced my staff by like 15%, and then we got 20% more revenue to do work.
Yeah.
So again, we were at capacity already. I'm losing staff, but you're adding more work.
Mm-hmm.
So this meant, you know, at the time I was like, well, I can't let our productivity fall. So I was working Saturdays and Sundays. I was working 12-hour days. So I was working all the time. I'm dealing with this PTSD stuff. I'm starting to go down this, and I was really depressed at the time. And so, yeah, the burnout was just incredible. Was incredible. And luckily, I was already engaged with a therapist that we could kind of talk about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But even then, you know, I was like, this is bad. I mean, pretty dark. It was pretty dark. Well, I'll share it. I said I was going to share it. So I remember one time talking to him, and he said, well, it's
my therapist. Okay.
Him saying, well, you know, I would worry if you had a suicide plan. And I did a sideways glance, and he goes, you don't have a plan, do you? And I said, well, what do you mean by a plan?
Yeah. He's like, oh.
And he goes, well, you know, have you thought it? And I was like, I could probably have it pretty well worked out. And so I told him, and that I won't disclose, but I, you know, shared with him what I had thought about. And he was like, yeah, that's a plan.
Yeah.
So that ramped up our level of therapy.
Yeah.
But so part of my plan then was to take a sabbatical because the smartest thing I did was I just said enough to working so
crazy
much.
Yeah,
and stuff's just not going to get done, right? So stuff started not getting done And within, you know, a 6 month period of time, people are upset because their work's not getting done. And I finally just had to say enough, right? So then the Hutch gave me some more resources. I was able to hire different people.
Get back that $3 work student. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So I talked to my supervisor, and kind of, you know, I just told him I was burned out, and he was like, yeah.
We can all see it.
Yeah. And he said, all right, you qualify for sabbatical, because employees that had been there for 10 years could apply for a sabbatical. So that was in by then it's like 2014. So I put my sabbatical plan together and I submitted it to the vice president. And she said, great, you can do it in 14 months.
Oh.
And I'm like, what the seriously? 14? I'm hanging by a thread. Okay. And I stuck it out, right? But in my head, I said, this is how much you value me, that you're making it difficult for me to do this thing that I've earned.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you it's urgent, and you're telling me 14 months still.
Yeah.
So that kind of, I mean, that just fit into kind of the trajectory that I was headed
for
the Hutch. So I did. I made it through that 14 months. And
oh, wow. Jeez.
And honestly, you know, I don't... The weird thing is the timing worked out better for the project I worked on. So that was good. And it also did allow me to do more work with my therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So... and really start to prioritize, okay, where do I need to put my energy? And he really started to prepare me to leave the Hutch. So part of who I am is, and again, I look back at how I was raised. So my parents were great about, you know what, if you want it, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want, you can do it. And if you don't get it, it's because you just didn't try hard enough, so try harder. Which, again, as a woman in science, hooray, you know, hooray. But that message only works if the system isn't whacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was happening is I was getting more and more successful at the Hutch. But the more successful I was getting, the more my administration was coming down on me for weird reasons.
As the great philosopher, Notorious B.I.G. said, more money, more problems. Yeah.
I was like, I'm doing better. My productivity is better. My lab is kicking ass. And I'm in trouble all the time.
Yeah.
So I was like, this doesn't make sense. You know, and so I was in that loop then of, well, then I need to try harder. And then I would get in more trouble. And so I tried harder. So it was just this loop of just...
It sounds horrible.
It was horrible. So, yeah. So I kind of started to... Because I always considered myself a Hutch pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pathologist at the Hutch. I'm a Hutch pathologist. And so then I started... It sounds funny, but I started to re-envision who I was as a pathologist who just happened to work at the Hutch,
mm-hmm.
right? So that helped reframe things. I did a lot of reframing in that period of time, and I worked a lot on my relationship with my husband, who was really supportive through all of this. He was great. He didn't always understand it, you know, but he was just so, so supportive. Yeah. I made it through that 14 months. And then I spent a couple months in Africa.
Oh, wow.
So I worked on a project opening a clinic. And I'd worked on the groundwork of that project. And this was, I we were opening a histology lab in Kampala, Uganda, at the clinic that the Hutch has a clinic there on the UCI, the Uganda Cancer Institute campus.
Okay.
And so we set up the lab. We had all the equipment. You know, we're going to ship it there, but we didn't have any technicians in Uganda that could really do the work. So we're trying to figure out how to do that. And we had identified a really great technician in Uganda. And we're like, well, maybe we should have her come to the States for a year and train. She has three little kids, right? Well, maybe we could send her to South Africa. Well, that's not going to work. So at the time, there was a woman who used to work for me who was in my lab learning a new skill because she had just been laid off so she could find a new job. And she was showing me pictures of her trip to Namibia. And she's a wildlife photographer. And I was like, hey, Linda, would you want to go to Africa for a year and train technicians? And she didn't even hesitate. She said, yes. I was like, yes. So I took Linda over to Africa and spent 2 months with her. And then I left her there to finish opening the lab.
Yeah.
And then came back and I did some other travel, did some scholarly work on that sabbatical. So I took 4 months off total.
Okay.
And when I came back, it was just a really great experience. It was doing something bigger than myself. Although the circumstances, you know, there's a huge bucket of need in Africa.
Yeah.
For the work. But it was just really fulfilling to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back and I felt, I felt like I transitioned out of that major depression. So then I came back and I told my boss, and the first day I came back, I said, well, I'm going to give you notice. I'll be here for a year, but I'm going to start looking. And he said, oh, I get it. That's reasonable. And then 6 weeks later, I quit.
And was it at that stage you knew you wanted to go into teaching, or did you accept a different role?
Well, I thought I was being recruited by industry because the work I did, microscopy, immunohistochemistry, kind of made sense. And I interviewed with a couple companies and I talked to a lot of different people about product management and things like that. It just didn't feel right, you know, and it just, the money was great, right? But then my husband, who's just so much smarter than I am, don't tell him that, he was like, why don't you teach? You know, you really like to teach. I thought, well, I guess so, but where, you know, I would want to teach at someone who was really invested in a mission, and you know, I'd want to teach where the student teacher ratio was reasonable and where teaching was a priority, not an afterthought, you know. And so I was kind of sorting that out when I got a phone call from a student here who used to work in my lab.
Oh wow.
So Danielle Welch. So Danielle was like, hey, I'm getting ready to graduate, you know, from that, remember that funky school you helped me fill up my application for? I was like, yeah. And she said, and weirdly, they're looking for a pathologist.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, I never would have known about the job because I had just started looking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know, we were ready to leave Seattle. We'd lived there for, you know, 18 years, and we kind of had enough of Seattle. And so, yeah, so I called, talked to Bill Elliott.
Billy, nice.
Yeah.
So I guess my question, though, is, you know, I guess my experiences with depression, part of my depression was I was working in the insurance and finance world, and I hated it. One, I wasn't very good at it. I think probably because I just didn't give a crap. I didn't try very hard. I was in a cubicle all day just goofing around. Absolutely hated it. And once I made a transition to pursue medicine, I was a pre-med student in community college classes where I was working odd jobs. Like I was an Uber at night and I was a student driving instructor. I was making so much less money compared to how I was making in finance, but I was so much happier doing something that I actually gave a crap about. But, you know, looking back, it's like, to treat my depression, it wasn't just a career change. So I guess my question for you, it's like, outside of, you know, adjusting your job, transitioning to this professor, like how, what else in your life changed to help you treat your depression?
Right. Well, I do think, you know, doing something you love, but also, so I loved the lab. Mm-hmm. I loved my work and my staff, they are amazing. They're amazing, amazing people. But it, you know, just the grind, the day-to-day grind, wasn't good for maintaining a good life balance. You know, I never did anything with my friends. I mean, even when I felt better and I wasn't isolating, mm-hmm. I never had time for friends and family. So that's really important for me to have a connection to people. Even though I'm an introvert, in small doses, I do need people. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time to hang out with my dogs very much. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a big dog person. So, you know, like here, this job affords me, I can go home at noon. I live 7 minutes away. I can walk my dogs, which is good for me too, because I'm disengaging from work. I'm doing some physical activity and I'm hanging out with my dogs.
Yeah.
Then I can come back here and I'm more centered.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and again, I think to just reevaluating what was important, like what, I was doing great work for a great institution, mm-hmm. but they didn't value me.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I hope people value me a little bit more. I don't know. They want me to come back.
So yeah, that's, I think they do.
That's a good thing. So, you know, it's hard to value yourself if you're pouring everything into, and that was the other thing. I poured everything into that job
mm-hmm.
instead of my family, my marriage, you know, everything was being diverted into that one pot.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I wasn't getting any value back.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
No, it does make sense. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes I think that's almost analogous to as a student perspective, like we feel sometimes put so much into just our grades, into like our board scores. It's like, well, how much is that really going to make you happy kind of thing? It's like you have to do other things, you know, to make you feel whole and make you feel like an actual person. So I guess what else I am curious about is, you know, now that you're in a...
Now through February 16th, join a clean and spacious Planet Fitness for zero enrollment and only $10 a month. With tons of equipment and free fitness training, it's the perfect place for everybody to work out.
Even me, Mr. I can't sleep at night, so I keep dozing off during the day.
Especially you, Snoozy. You'll rest easier and feel fit-tacular.
Wait, how did you get in here?
Join in club or at planetfitness.com. Zero enrollment, $10 a month, cancel anytime. Hurry, deal ends February 16th. See club for details.
Very different role. Like what elements of PTSD, what elements of depression still kind of linger that you sometimes find challenging?
So definitely, you know, I definitely know that I have triggers from PTSD. You know, a lot of it is personal space stuff. So I'm very much like, okay, why is my heart racing? Oh, you're just standing a little too close to me, right? Do I have a clear eyesight to an exit?
Yeah.
When Dr. Ford was testifying at the Kavanaugh hearing, whatever they call it, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, yep, I get where, you know, so. You know, a lot of the things that she was talking about, her anxiety levels and things like that. So I still, you know, I still definitely have triggers, but now I kind of know when they'll start, and I can do the work to manage that. You know, depression, again, I have to just keep an eye on it. I have to keep an eye on making sure I'm doing things that, that I value, but also, so the bitch about this is that I'm transitioning through menopause.
Mm. Oh yeah, right? We haven't touched on this yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you notice my face is red and I'm taking my sweater and my cardigan off, I'm taking my shirt off. No. It's because I'm having a hot flash, right? Mm-hmm. So this has kind of thrown my whole management off, okay. Right? Because part of my depression too is hormonally controlled. So I'm on an oral birth control, even though, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not using it for birth control because I need that estrogen. But I needed that before I started to go through menopause.
Okay.
So I've been on that, is that's my drug treatment, right?
Yeah.
And that works for a good subset of women with hormonally induced depression. But now, my whole hormone thing is wackadoodle.
Okay.
So that and my sleep cycle is way off. So there's a couple different factors. The decline in estrogen messes up serotonin and all that other stuff, but it also alters your sleep cycle, plus the hot flashes, mm-hmm. which, you know, if anyone ever makes fun of a hot flash in front of me, I think I'll kill them. Especially if I'm flashing at the time. It wakes you up. I've been waking up about 8 to 10 times a night.
Oh, geez. Wow.
Yeah. So I have my little Fitbit, right, mm-hmm. that kind of tells me what's going on. So, you know, like I said before, sleep, like if I don't have good sleep hygiene, that I know that's, I need to be super careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that and then physical activity tends to set off hot flashes as well. So I haven't been walking as much. So I'm like, all right, we got to figure stuff out. Because I feel myself, like I can feel like, oh, yeah, Andrea called me. Oh, I'll call her in 2 days.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. Oh, let's go get dinner. No, you know, so I can feel I'm starting to isolate.
Yeah.
So I'm going back to my doctor. I have a new therapist here who I like a lot. And so we're working together on a plan.
There you go. Okay.
And I think that's a thing again, to further complicate everything, I've also just been diagnosed with IBS.
Oh, okay. Lucky you.
Lucky me. So, you know, it's, there's some literature, because I am that nerd, there's some literature that people with IBS are more prone to depression.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And they're not sure, and it doesn't look like, oh, you're depressed because you're dealing with this chronic illness that there's no cure for.
And maybe like social embarrassment or...
Yeah, for me, yeah. It could be that, or but they're finding more that, no, the depression preceded the IBS.
Okay.
So now they're starting to look at the neural pathways, and because IBS is more of a sensory issue. Well, you know this.
I wonder if it's like the serotonin tracks, like in the gut. Because I try to do a lot of research. Not a lot. I should never say that. But like marijuana-induced hyperemesis syndrome,
mm-hmm.
like I find fascinating, and I really want to learn more about that. And that's what they theorize, is maybe it's the serotonin receptor that's being hit through the excessive amount of THC. I wonder. And it always makes me, one of the facts that sticks with me the most, is it ulcerative colitis where smoking is like, it helps with the management of it?
Yeah,
that's such an odd, weird thing. And like the nicotinic receptors, it's very, very strange.
This is the one time I'm going to tell you to smoke, right?
Yeah.
And that's, throw a patch on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, I think for a long time, you know, people are like, well, depression is a weakness in your character. IBS is just because you can't handle anxiety.
Mm.
You know, all these, you know, menopause is just these symptoms you're having are just an excuse for you to be bitchy, you know. And you know, the more I'm looking at this, and you know, the library's been great because I'm like, okay, I need all the stuff you have about this. But I'm starting to see that, you know, the neurological background, the biochemistry behind all these seem, I'm starting to map it out and say, oh, well, you know, IBS is could be a symptom of the same underlying condition I have that leaves me more prone to depression.
Yeah.
Right? Which, you know, could be, again, women who have IBS have a harder time with IBS. Women with IBS have a harder time with menopause and, okay, you know, it's this whole thing. So I'm like, okay. And I think, again, for me, I am an information person. So it helps me to do this research. My husband's like, what are you doing? You know, I've got all these papers and I'm taking them home. And but that also makes me feel more in control of what's happening to me that I have no control over. You know, one of the things that's so frustrating to me is that, so I've just been diagnosed with IBS, and as a pathologist, there's no histological change, there's no biochemical test, nothing. Mm-hmm. It is killing me. Like, I can't look through the lab results and do anything but have a diagnosis of exclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So unfair.
Yeah, it's a cop-out.
So unfair, right? So, you know, yeah, but now
welcome
I know.
Welcome to psychiatry.
Yeah, I don't know how, I mean, I didn't think about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's really one of the main reasons why I wanted to go to medical school, because I considered actually being a therapist for a very long time, but I wanted to understand the objective means of mental illness.
Right.
And maybe being able to make diagnosis before we see these incredibly severe symptoms. So that's really what drove me more towards medicine.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That does make sense. So yeah, so now I'm trying to manage stuff that doesn't have a bio, like I can't track my IBS marker over time, you know. But yeah, you know, that's actually, I'm knocking on wood, the IBS, once we figured it out, has been pretty easy to manage, which I'm grateful for, because that usually isn't the case. But yeah, it just, all this stuff, like, okay, I'm on a good management track, and yeah, moving to Yakima, starting a new job, stressful, but, you know, I've got a therapist who's, works on stress, chronic stress. Yeah, I'm starting to meditate, which is really hard for me to do.
Uh-huh.
But it's like a little mini nap. It's amazing, right? If I can, I'm learning how to calm my mind. You know, and then, pew! Yeah. IBS, pew!
Literally.
Menopause.
More like punk. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of blew up my management.
Uh-huh.
My management plan. So now I'm putting it back together.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I always describe, like, managing a mental illness, it's like a balancing rope or a tightrope or whatever. You know, trying to figure it out. And like, so I've been on Valproate now for, what year is it? I've been on it for 7 years now. And, you know, I've been gaining weight because of poor lifestyle choices. But it's also, like, I think I've been struggling with my weight, and I think it's part of, because of the Valproate, which is traditionally, for the listeners, like one of the most famous weight gain meds.
Yeah. And it's like when you put a patient on a gabapentin.
Yeah.
And they go boop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating, because then from my perspective, though, it's like I'm almost afraid to change the system if it's not completely broken yet. Like, yes, I'm overweight, but I can hopefully get my act together. But it's you know, before I go through the whole residency selection, and residency is going to be incredibly stressful. It's like, do I want to make another change right prior to this? It makes me incredibly, incredibly nervous. And so still I just, I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to change anything.
And that's the thing, right? So you got to weigh that. And now there'll never be a perfect time, right? Because then you'll be starting your practice and you'll be, you know, other things will come up. But I always cringe when I get first year students, they're new to school, and you know, maybe an advisee or I'm chatting with them and they're like, you know what, I think I'm going to be fine because I just went back on my ADHD medication 2 weeks ago and starting Sci-Fam, so I should be fine. And I'm like,
yeah.
No. Yeah. And I, you know, medications all come with side effects that that are horrible, right? But I think, you know, you have to balance with, yeah, being overweight, more prone to other diseases, maybe, you know, not as happy with your body, but I'm not in a pit of despair.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. And I think, too, as a medical student, you have to prioritize, right? I mean, yeah, I think you should definitely, healthy lifestyle is important for other reasons, balance, all that stuff. But you also have a lot on your plate right now, right? So when I was in graduate school, probably, well, the odd thing was, again, what really helped my depression then is the parking was so horrible on campus at Ohio State that I got to campus at about 5:15.
Oh, God.
And I would spend an hour in the gym.
Oh, okay.
I was in amazing shape.
Oh, okay.
Then, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think about it then, but that really helped.
You know,
I think that helped my management. But, you know, you don't always have that time to do that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It just...
Yeah. Well, so one of the... I always like to kind of finish episodes more on, like, an advice, I guess, sort of element.
Just and be careful.
No, well, you're the one giving advice, not me. Yeah, but I guess when I first made this podcast, I never envisioned some of the effects, and so I've done now a few episodes, maybe three, or and I guess this is now the fourth, dealing with sexual assault, and I guess I never realized how profound of an impact those stories have over my story about bipolar disorder, because it's like, well, you know, roughly 4% of the population deals with bipolar disorder, but like sexual assault, I don't even, you know the stats much better than me, but it's like 1 out of 4 undergraduate women experience some means of sexual assault. It's insane. And so, like, I mean, I would get people messaging me after I would release those stories. And one of the most cool episodes is I got this girl who messaged me, who then ended up coming on the show, and now she's going to medical school next year. So it was a very, very kind of cool experience for me. But so what, I guess, advice would you give to, I guess, one, someone who experiences that horrific experience, but also someone like me who has not experienced anything like that, but how can I make the environment easier for someone to report or just deal with the aftermath, or I don't know.
Yeah, I think the big thing is to avoid, well, for you to avoid anything that sounds blaming or shaming, right? So victims often feel to blame. I felt to blame. I felt this was my fault. You know, and it's not. And again, that was a lot of the work, was realizing this was not my fault. None of this was my fault. So educating yourself on, you know, what the root of sexual assault was really, you know, it's you know, what the root is. Not blaming yourself. You know, there's a huge amount of shame as well. And then there's a whole host of other cultural things. You know, again, other cultures about female sexuality that you carry with you, right? So I would say, you know, if you've been a victim of sexual assault, you really need to find someone to help you work through the process. And it kind of needs to be someone not a family member or a spouse or a boyfriend, girlfriend. And I say that because they're going to try and make you feel better, right? And I often too, you know, I worried about them. Like I worried about telling my parents and telling my husband, he was now my husband, but my boyfriend at the time. You know, I worried about telling them because I didn't want to hurt them. So finding someone who you can talk to who you know, will help you through the process is huge. It, you know, if it's a rape counselor or a therapist, you know, a school counselor, anyone that you can talk to who's going to objectively help you. I mean, yeah, sure, they're going to care about you, but they're not as emotionally invested in you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know what? If you need to drop it for a little bit so you can make it through the day, I think, you know, Janelle Mapes talked about this with sexual harassment too. You know, it might be that you just can't deal with it right at that period of time, but make sure that you come back to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One concept that I've had with, you know, a few of my peers and who've experienced things like you, taught me, you know, structuring, because I'm going to see a lot of these patients in my future practice, right? Not trying to look at it like, oh, you're a victim of this, but you're a survivor of this kind of thing. And the subtle differences between that, how like you survive through this, you're stronger because of this versus you're broken because of this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I get that. I also, I would have preferred other challenges to be stronger.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people who've survived sexual assault are like, you know what, I would have preferred to, you know, climb Mount Rainier and
yeah.
But you know, victimizing what happened is not always helpful. Oh, you poor thing, you know. But helping people see a way through, you know, helping again to unwrap it, look at it, take the shame out of it, take the blame out of it, and look at it for what it really is. It's a crime and it's an assault. You know, we wouldn't talk the same way about if you were robbed,
mm-hmm.
or if someone randomly, or not even, or one of your friends beat the shit out of you. You know, we would have language really different than we still have about sexual assault.
Mm.
So, you know, again, I think being able to frame it as what it really is, it's a crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess any last words of advice for a student out there, maybe student or any professor, I guess, you know, you're my first professor I've interviewed about their own personal story, who's dealing with these kind of issues, how would you want them to, what would have helped you, I guess, hearing?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, being able to say I'm not the first person to be in a professorial position to have depression and PTSD.
Yeah.
I mean, I know colleagues, right? And we see quirky behavior in people, and we kind of,
mm-hmm. Especially professors.
Yeah. And we kind of, and sometimes it's charming, sometimes it's not, but we kind of pass it off as quirky behavior. I think being able to honestly reach out to folks and say, you know, I'm concerned about you. I think there's a lot of burnout in academia. And to remove kind of that stigma from academia, you know, we're prized for our minds.
Mm.
And it is hard to step out there and say, you know, my mind sometimes is a little broken. but it doesn't make me a less effective professor. So if we can look at that and say, you know, you're going to be a great physician because you've had medical challenges, right? I'm hopefully going to be a better professor because I've had medical challenges, some of which happen to be mental health challenges.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would encourage, you know, students for valuing their mental health and realizing that it's not, if you have a mental health issue, it's not a weakness. And I think that's hard for physicians, right? They're supposed to be all powerful. And two, for my colleagues, you know, we need to do a better job looking out for each other and helping identify burnout. And, you know, again, if you need someone to bounce, you know, hey, this is how I was feeling. Yeah, that's where I was when I was in the peak of my burnout.
Yeah. 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 Well, cool. Well, that's about an hour of us chatting. So thanks again for coming on and, sure. and you know, offering your story. Like I said, I mean, I just like to think of all the numbers of all of it. Like I said earlier, like 4% is only bipolar-ish or so, but so many people are going to experience something similar to you, sadly. But it's just a reality. So I'm sure a lot of the classmates here on campus have experienced something similar. So I think you're going to be an even better resource than you already are here on campus. Yeah, so thanks again.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
The I didn't realize you liked me that way deal. Because it's one thing to receive McDonald's, but an entirely other thing to know that they woke up early to face the world and bring you McDonald's breakfast still hot in the bag.
Appreciate you.
There's a deal for every morning. Now grab two loaded sausage burritos for only $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.